Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield. And once again, we've reached that time of the month where we are releasing our latest magazine. And this time we are taking on the German giants that are Bayern Munich. I have to say, at the time of recording, this is the earliest we've ever recorded a magazine podcast. In fact, some of these articles have probably only just been handed in. We're that well organised. However, by the time this reaches your ears, you will be fully aware, you'll have had the warnings, you will be hopefully ready to press the order button at 1 minute past midnight, like some of the keen collectors are. But for this podcast, I am joined by the usual Holy Trinity that is, first of all, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
Thanks, Duke. Nice to be on talking about the next magazine and a really interesting club. I'll be looking at this this time in the mag as well. So yeah, gonna be great fun talking about the mag.
It's we were saying that when we came on before, I think it's one of those, and we'll chat about the club in a second, but it was one of those where you sort of wondered how much value there would be in it, and then once you get into it, actually there's an awful lot of value in it.
Ain't the just, and it's one of these clubs that, you know, have didn't sort of excel for 5 years, 10 years. You know, they've had periods of dominance for over the last 50 years. Not all the way through, but not far short. Not far short. You know, they hold the record for the most Bundesliga wins, the most German Cup wins, the most German League Cup wins. Won the European Cup more time than any other German club. You know, as domination goes in the country, Bayern Munich is it in Germany. That's for sure.
It's and talking of domestic domination, our next guest is Mr. Aidan Williams. So nothing you would know anything about it.
It didn't take long.
We get our Newcastle dig in at the start. Bring it on.
Well, I was going to go to the last guest, but then I was like, well, no, because that's just the same. How are you feeling about the Bayern mag? Was there any envy, any silver envy, or were you okay with it?
It's like it's a whole different sport, Stu. You know, when we talk about these teams, it's got no relation to my club whatsoever, which is just as well, really, because it makes for a far more interesting magazine that way. So, yes, very much looking forward to this one. It is one of the mega clubs, of course, of world football, European football right now. And yeah, as you're saying with Gary, people are slightly anti some of the utterly dominant clubs, aren't they? But when you think about it, there is so much to tell about them. I've even come prepared with a giant German Bavarian brew to sup along with them. There's no Lederhosen, though. Don't worry about that. But no, this will be a great one because there's so many great tales to tell once we delve beneath the surface of this club.
To be fair, we can only see you from the shoulders up. So you say that. And obviously, back to domestic dominance and silverware, our final guest, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome to this edition of the magazine podcast.
Oh, I've been looking forward. I'm so prepared for this evening as well. It's so untrue. I don't think I've ever been more prepared for a podcast. But yes, what a team to be doing.
To be fair, we were supposed to start 40 minutes ago, but that's okay, don't worry.
Yeah, one of us forgot that this podcast was taking place, naming no names, but yeah, one of the four.
Have a guess.
But yes, I wouldn't mind, but I remembered this earlier in the day. Totally forgot by about 4:30. And then that's it. Sat there watching Top of the Pops 1991, thinking, is Bryan Adams ever going to be knocked off the top of the charts here? No, it's got to happen eventually. And then the message pops through, thinking, well, I'm meant to be somewhere. Where am I? But yes, meant to be on Bayern Munich. And Bayern Munich, yes, they are the great Dick Dastardly. They are the proper archetypal villain of the piece. And within that, that makes this magazine kind of like quite unique, you know, because it's what we've got to do here is kind of, you know, I don't know, it's that appreciation for something that a lot of people can't really appreciate or they don't think to appreciate. It was funny, the other day I was doing a podcast about the new book, about the European Cup, and the interviewer in question went through all the teams that had won it, you know, talked about Real Madrid and all of this, and it was Benfica, it was the Milans, it was Celtic, Manchester United, through Feyenoord and Ajax, and then Bayern was completely missed. He jumped from Bayern to the British domination, to Liverpool, to Forest, to Villa. And it made me laugh because they are just completely underappreciated in so many respects, because they are basically the imperial forces. You know, the Bayern Munich should enter the stadium to the sound of the imperial death march of you know, it is the Empire Strikes Back. But within that, you know, they have such a brilliant place in the football firmament. You know, there has to be a place for the villain, and I think this probably glorifies that, you know, and within that, you know, it's that you get past that facade of the villain and see so many cool stories behind it and so many wonderful players and wonderful achievements. And they are Bayern Munich.
I mean, I did try and get Darth Vader for this podcast, but he was busy. So yeah, we couldn't get him. Like we said, I mean, before we sort of get into that, before we get into the club, obviously, you know, we should make people aware. 4th of October is when this is available to order. It's 14 articles that go from Kurt Landauer and Nazi defiance to your article, Stephen, that covers 1970-77. Paul Breitner, Beckenbauer, the 1980s, the boardroom, Mehmet Scholl, 1996-2004. The goalkeepers, which is obviously your article, Aidan, that we'll come to. Philip Lahm, Gert Müller and Lewandowski, which is obviously your article, Gary. Robin and Ribery, Thomas Müller, and 2011-2016. It, like I say, when the list came through, and you know, as you've all said there, it's, you sort of look at it and think, yes, it's a magazine we should do. Yeah, it will sort of go through the motions. But when you actually look at the list of articles that are there, it should be a really, really good read with lots of interesting stuff. A lot of things on there that, like you say, you think you know, or whether you take the time to know, but actually there's some really good stuff in there. So like I say, this is your first sort of heads up and warning that it is, by the time you're listening to this, it is available to order, and it will smell really, really nice, as always. So we'll start off then. We'll start with you then, Gary. Bayern Munich, obviously Stephen's given a great monologue there and compared them to the Imperial Forces within the galaxy. How do you see Bayern Munich?
The Battle of Hoth. That is what they are, the Battle of Hoth. At-ats everywhere. You know, all of that going on. Sorry, Gary, go on.
No, Steve's sort of cinematographic description, but I actually understand exactly where he's coming from. And Bayern Munich are one of these clubs that you probably respect more than admire, more than like. I mean, you do admire them, but you don't get the romantic connection with Bayern Munich that you get with a lot of clubs, you know, with the Barcelonas, with the Milans, with Ajax. It just doesn't exist there because whether it's because... And it's not because they don't have great players. It's not because they don't have fantastic flair players either. We'll touch on some of those players when we go through. And it's not because they weren't successful. But it's just that sort of they're sort of perceived as being efficient and serial winners, I suppose, is the other thing that counts against them, which is a strange thing to say, but you know, an upstart victory seems to generate more romance in football than, you know, the team that sort of wins league after league after league. And, you know, the domination of Bayern Munich, as we mentioned earlier, I mean, going back to the 70s and up to date now, I mean, I don't know how many Bundesligas there's one on the bounce at the moment, but it's more than two, that's for sure. And there's no sort of end of it in sight. So I think you've got to sort of give respect to the club, and, you know, and because of that and because of their success, and they are one of the mega clubs of Europe, as I mentioned. You know, that, you know, we had to do a magazine about them. And once you start dipping below that sort of veneer of efficiency, you see lots of stories under there, and you know, many of which are covered in the magazine.
I absolutely agree, Gary. And it's those stories that always certainly that interest me and certainly interest us on the podcast, those lesser known stories. But I guess, Aidan, you know, when it comes to Bayern Munich, you can't get away from the efficiency. You can't get away from almost the monotony. I know we are trying to sell this magazine. I need to remember that. but it is almost a monotonous churning out of victories of success. And Gary makes a great point. You know, it's when Bayern Munich are defeated in a competition that actually that's when people take an interest in Bayern Munich.
It's true. And when Gary was mentioning Ajax there, and there's a big comparison, of course, in the 1970s of, you know, Ajax had 3 years of dominance and then Bayern had 3 years of dominance. And you kind of think, well, why is one thought of more fondly than the other? They both played great football. Bayern, you know, they weren't just the machine-like performers. They were slick. They were interchanging positions as well. Perhaps not to the extent of Ajax and the Dutch, but still, they were playing forward-thinking football at the time. So why are they the sort of modern beast, whereas Ajax are, you know, the guardians of all that is good and holy about football? And I guess it's because they haven't faded away to some extent. You know, Ajax have had other little peaks too, I suppose, but Bayern have just seemingly got stronger and stronger. And then it comes down now, you put them in the category with the likes of Juventus and PSG and maybe Real and Barca club together in Spain. Mega clubs that are totally dominating their league, maybe PSG and Juventus is a poor example now since they both lost the league last season. But, you know, the years and years of domination, it's probably a blip that they didn't. And Bayern are doing exactly the same. There was a little interruption with Borussia Dortmund, but, you know, normal service gets resumed pretty quick. So we're automatically, well, many of us anyway, are sort of automatically against that sort of dominance because it just seems bad for football, bad for the game, bad for competition. And therefore, as you say, yes, things get interesting when they get knocked out. I don't know, but they weren't always this way. There's a lot in their past. They weren't originally in the Bundesliga, you know. They had to come through regional league first to get in there. And they worked their way up. They kind of earned their way in, paid their dues. But then they've just become this absolute behemoth that we all now love to hate. But in telling their tales, we focus a lot more on the past than the present. There are some more about modern times in the magazine too. But a lot of what will be great will be a lot of the things looking at the glorious past and some of the great names. And in looking at the articles in this magazine and also looking at the one I wrote, the more you get into it, the more you're discovering the great stories behind this club. And it really is. So it's a great club. It's turned into a modern beast, but that doesn't change the fact that there's so many great iconic moments and players and teams to discuss and delve into. So yes, another great magazine. Absolutely.
Can you just jump in for a second there, Stu?
I'd
mentioned about the changing of the dominance in Europe from Ajax to Bayern Munich. There was a game the last time Ajax won the European Cup, 1973. They played Bayern Munich in the semi-final or quarter-final, I can't remember. I think it was a semi-final. And they beat Bayern 4-0 at home to Amsterdam. And I was writing about this from a book I did on the on the beautiful bridesmaids dressed in orange. And I managed to get in the conversation with Rafa Honigstein about it. And he was saying that in that game, the Germans were playing, Bayern were playing a similar, they'd adopted the style of the Dutch. And for example, Brighton, who we talk about later, you wrote about Stu, is a defender playing in midfield. Beckenbauer was a midfield player playing as a libero. And, you know, Bayern had adopted very much that sort of interchange position and the what we call the game depression pressing now of that Ajax played. So, you know, they perhaps don't get given the credit that they should have done for the way they adopted the new way of play and obviously picked up the crown that Ajax dropped when they were knocked out of the competition the following year.
You have to wonder whether how much of this is down to stereotypes of Germany and Germans rather than, you know, our view of the free-thinking Dutch. And it just didn't fit our preconceived narrative of how Germans should be. But you're absolutely right. The way they played, you're exactly right.
We'll start with you in 1 second, Stephen, because obviously your article is that 1970 to 1977 sort of time period, which will cover that really well. But just picking up on what Gary and Aidan have both said, and this sort of dominance, and it's not a perceived dominance, it's a clear and obvious dominance. But in this country, you know, do we have a club that is similar to Bayern Munich, or are we lucky in England that, you know, we managed to sort of keep the cycles going relatively quickly? Obviously, we have the period of dominance by Manchester United, but and Liverpool the H, but do we, you know, are we lucky that we don't have that one club dominance?
Certainly at the minute we do. I mean, we've had that type of thing before, but even then it's been, I don't know, a slightly different spin on the theme. I think the closest we've come is when Manchester United and Arsenal had a decade where no one else won the title. You know, even at Liverpool's, you know, title winning peak, you know, they were always challenged by, you know, a succession of a convoy of different clubs, really, be it Leeds, Derby, Forest, Villa, Everton. You know, they all came and went and offered their own challenge all the way up to George Graham's Arsenal. And Bayern had periods like that throughout the 70s, the 80s and the 90s. It's only kind of like a more contemporary time, the last decade, that things have really, really taken a stranglehold. They've had periods where they've won 3-4 league titles on the road, but you know, you would always find that there would be a compelling team that would come through to challenge them, and the last of them being Jurgen Klopp's Dortmund, really. So yes, now is a very, very difficult time, I think, because football needs that variation. But no, in England, we don't tend to have that. You know, say that I think the closest we've had is that period between Ferguson and Wenger, where I think it went from Blackburn Rovers 95, didn't it, to Chelsea 2005, 2004-ish. It was literally just either Ferguson's United or Wenger's Arsenal, no matter what people say about the 90s, the second half of the 90s, and that misty-eyed view that is being propelled now, I think, so much. You know, there was a hegemony then that there isn't now. You know, at least in the Premier League, we can now turn around and say in the last 5 or 6 years, yes, Manchester City have this, you know, amazing, you know, advantage over everyone, but they've not been able to wield it in a way that's kept everyone else at bay. Liverpool, Leicester, Chelsea have all managed to win the title as well within the last 5 or 6 years. So, you know, we are quite fortunate here that we're not in a position where it's like PSG in France, although they didn't win last year, as Aidan said, you know, Juventus and Serie A up until last season, and Bayern Munich now. You know, it is why we look back more than kind of like a round of what we have now, I think, you know, and that's just us. I'm not saying that about the magazine or, you know, wider media, but, you know, we tend to cast back rather than look around us. You know, I think if things kind of like were more competitive, I think we'd all embrace the way football is now, because there's beautiful football. This conversation I had the other day on a podcast about the book was that, I think, I declared football now to still be good, but it's a different type of good to what it was, and I would place these hegemonies within these monopolies.
Well, okay, so getting into the articles then, and Aidan has touched on it, but we'll start with you then, Stephen. And you, like I say, you cover 70 to 77, of which there is that period of dominance that sort of sits in the middle. Certainly in terms of European dominance as well. But why 70 to 77? It's a 7-year period that you chose to write about. Why? What made you bookend those dates?
It was a 7-year period that ended up typically stretching back a further 7 years. You know, within that, you know, you're looking at it, and again, it was a bit like... I can't remember the article I wrote now for one of the other magazines, and it ended up over Valencia, and it stretched to virtually 20 years and about 8,000 words. This didn't get to those kind of type of levels this time, but you did have to cast back, as like Aidan said earlier on. You know, they as a club, they were not, you know, under the umbrella of the debut Bundesliga campaign in 63-64. know, the complex way in which the National League was drawn together and the stipulations and the rules and the clubs that were invited. You know, one of the stipulations were that, you know, no two clubs from one city could be in it. 1860 Munich having the most recent successes meant that it was they rather than Bayern that were invited, despite the fact that at that point in time, having been a relatively unremarkable team, they were clearly a team on the up and improving season upon season. You know, this was a team that was cut adrift into the out of the Bundesliga into the regional Liga system at a time when they had Settmeier, Franz Beckenbauer and Gerd Müller on the books. You know, they were that ambitious and that you know, forward thinking that their response to being excluded from the inaugural league, you know, Bundesliga season, was to employ Zlatko Kajkowski, who had won the one of the last German championships, the pre-Bundesliga German championship with Cologne. He'd been a Cologne player. He'd won the title with Cologne as a manager, as coach. Bayern swooped for his services in the summer of 1963, despite not being invited into the Bundesliga. So, you know, it took him 2 years to drag them out of the regional Liga. But once he did, by 66, he was winning the German Cup. By 67, the Cup Winners' Cup was won. And, you know, you had to look at these foundations. You know, he handed over to Branko Zebek, who provided Bayern with their first Bundesliga title before he moved on. You know, Zebek eventually went to Hamburg. He took them to the 1980 European Cup final. So, you know, these managers were, you know, very, very omnipresent and they were important parts of the story. So you couldn't leave them out. But the big protagonists were Udo Lattek and Detmar Kramer. You know, Udo Lattek is just synonymous throughout the 1970s. He's a fascinating character, you know, that spanned the two sides of the West German coin in the 1970s. You know, the story's remarkable. You know, no discernible club coaching experience whatsoever. He'd been part of the prolific West German setup with the DFB, one of the backup coaches to Helmut Schön at the 66 World Cup, as was Kramer. So, you know, he was recruited from that basis. And then he took them on this wild ride. You know, he made them domestically imperious. He won them the first European Cup in 74 with that style that Aidan said. You know, if you want a really good example of how good Lattek's Bayern Munich were, look at the replay of the 1974 European Cup final. You know, they are wondrous in that game. You know, Gerd Müller is just, you know, spectacular. And that side is just dripping with talent. And then by January 1975, he's sacked. You know, they have a sluggish start to the domestic season and is ruthlessly sacked. He, you know, legend has it that he went to the board to say, look, you know, we need to make changes here, meaning that, you know, he needs the funds to replenish his squad and to freshen his squad up. And they said, yes, we agree, changes are needed. You're sacked, you know, and out he went, you know, to be replaced by Detmar Kramer eventually. And, you know, a very different Bayern spring forth, a more pragmatic one, because Detmar Kramer's Bayern he never wins a domestic trophy for them, yet he leads them to the next two European Cups. You know, this is almost like a reversal of what Ajax do. You know, you look at Ajax and Rinus Michels and how he creates this or he propagates this, you know, growing, you know, culture of football that's handed to him via Vic Buckingham and prior to that, the teachings of Jack Reynolds. But there's a lot of control. There's a lot of control freakery behind Rinus Michels. And, you know, there's a lot of discipline in there. He moves on in 71, takes the Barcelona job and is replaced by Stefan Kovacs, who essentially, you know, gives the players freedom that Rinus Michels never gave them. You know, he just takes the handbrake off and says, let's freewheel downhill for the next 2 years and see what we create, you know, to hell with the damage at the end of it, you know, and that's pretty much the Kovacs way. But within that, Bayern do it in the opposite direction. You know, Lattek is the free thinker. He is the one with all the expansion. And then Kramer comes and tightens the control. within that, that means that domestically they struggle, but in Europe they conquer. But they do so in a more pragmatic way. You know, that concept of the, you know, the empire striking back. You know, there is a little bit of, you know, that Leeds final in 75. You know, get a Leeds United fan on about the 1975 European Cup final, and they will tell you about the dark arts and how it was all wrong and everything. You know, I don't buy into a crooked referee. I do buy into an inept referee and some bad luck going against Leeds United. But at the same time, you know, there were other aspects as well that should have stopped Leeds winning that anyway. The fact that they should have been down to 10 men from around about the second minute was one of them. But then in 76, you know, you have Saint-Étienne, the wondrous Saint-Étienne being denied by the square goalposts of Hampden Park and stuff like that. So this is where the Bayern Munich of the future stems from those two finals. Go back a year, even with him winning in 74, with such style in the replay, there is the fact that in the initial game, the seconds away from losing it, you know, it's the 119th minute when they get the equalised to take the game to a replay. So this is, you know, this sleight of hand, but a lot of what Udo Lattek did for Bayern Munich is lost within this bogeyman storyline that Bayern Munich have been handed, you know, and within that, you know, the amazing thing being that once Lattek leaves Bayern, his response is to take over at Borussia Mönchengladbach in the summer of 75. You know, the team that had been the one that could go toe-to-toe in West Germany with Bayern Munich throughout the first half of the 1970s. Hannes Weisweiler, you know, the coach there, takes on the Barcelona job, and Lattek is the replacement. So Lattek, who knows Bayern inside out, is suddenly in charge of the biggest rival. And it just makes for a fascinating landscape of West German football that rumbles on and goes on into Europe as well. And it's just, you know, a wonderfully evocative era packed with, you know, amazing games and amazing players.
Just a second there, Stu. Game that Steve mentioned, the 74 final, I think, of play Atletico Madrid. And they're losing. And the goal that Steve mentioned was scored from the most unlikely of sources. It was George Schwarzenbach.
George Schwarzenbach scored
the goal in the last minute. And it's one of those sliding door moments. If George Schwarzenbach had a chance his arm in that last few seconds of the game, the history of Bayern Munich, and certainly the 70s, might well have been very different. Sliding door moments.
I was going to ask you actually, Gary. I mean, obviously, you know, as we all know, and you know, the listeners will know, obviously, your love of Ajax, and those, you know, we've mentioned it already. Those sort of those three victories that come, you know, on the bounce straight after Ajax. Do you think the perception of Bayern is almost hindered by what came before it in the preceding 3 years?
Yeah, I think that's true. And sort of almost going back to what Hayden said, you know, and the perception were that these were these efficient Germans turning up and, you know, their efficiency squashed the glorious romanticism of Ajax. And it could be more untrue in that 74 vintage of Bayern, although perhaps afterwards, as Stevie alluded to, it might have been more the case. But yes, I mean, I think any team that followed Ajax, especially as you know, as I say, I mentioned earlier, you know, in the previous year, Ajax sort of won comfortably 4-0 against them. And I think they went to Munich and got a 1-1 draw, I think, to eliminate Bayern. And yet the following year, they took over the crown. And it's looking on paper, and it looks like, you know, how's that happened? You know, these people were the darlings of football, and all of a sudden they got crushed by this Teutonic efficiency. But that really wasn't the case. The game, as I said, in the 72-73 season when Ajax won the last title, was very much close to the 4-0 scoreline, so let's suggest. And the football they were playing wasn't that dissimilar.
I mean, Aidan, again, I suppose a similar question to, you know, to what I've just asked Gary there. Winning the European Cup 3 years in a row is a legacy all by itself that very few clubs have done. I mean, even the great Liverpool side couldn't manage to win it 3 years in a row. They didn't do badly. They had a year off, but they couldn't do it 3 years in a row. But do you think that has also sort of not tarnished the legacy as well? But, you know, any side, it's similar with, you know, with Real Madrid. They've done it twice now in two different eras. But do you think that that dominance almost generates a feeling of, I don't know what the word is, not resentment, but almost an anti-love, for want of a better word, of a club, because they won it 3 years in a row. And like you say, people don't like that perceived dominance.
I think probably in the 70s it will have done, yeah, or maybe even from the 80s, and not too far removed from it, as to still be quite fresh. If you think of that happening now, then yes, you're exactly right. That would be all the feelings everyone would have, would just be our same old again. You know, Real Madrid won 2 in 3 years, I think. Barcelona won 2 in 3 years, but nobody quite managed the 3 in a row in recent times. But even then, people were starting to get a bit, a bit down on the fact that it was a little bit the same each time in terms of the teams getting to the latter stages of these competitions. So yes, I would be quite certain that closer to the time, those feelings would have been the case. I think from the distance now of, dare I say it, nearly half a century from those events, which is quite a scary prospect. I think now it doesn't have that impact at all anymore. You look back and you see that great era of dominance, and what you are now, I think, is more intrigued as to how that was achieved. Was it through utter dominance, or was it, as the guys were saying there, about close calls and sliding door moments and, you know, twists of fate? Was it purely that they were so utterly dominant? And no, maybe it wasn't quite that. So there's more to it. And I think looking back from the benefit of that distance in time, you appreciate that side of it far more than you would do if it was closer to hand. So I think, yes, if such an era happened now, and we have come close to it on a number of occasions, as I say, maybe Gary Chelsea will win the next 2 Champions Leagues as well, and we'll all be sick to the back teeth of them. But, you know, I wouldn't hold your breath. But, you know, I think in modern times we would exactly feel like that. And I imagine back in the 70s people did a bit too. But no, not now. I don't think it tarnishes anything. It's in the same way that we look back on Real Madrid's 1950s successes as a sort of wondrous era of a great team, and you look at the great players they had and think, well, this really was European royalty. We feel exactly the same about Ajax in the early 70s, and we should feel the same about Bayern in the mid 70s as well, because the players they had were European royalty. And the way it came together, obviously a few twists of fate here and there helping them on their way. But it was an iconic team at an iconic time. I think we'd feel differently if we were closer to the time.
And talking of this time span, I guess, you know, it leads us nicely into your article. And for me, I think looking at the magazines now and sort of thinking back what we've done, features on goalkeepers there doesn't seem to be many, and certainly not many that spring to mind, which again, you know, when I got the list, I was like, oh, brilliant, you know, an article on, you know, on goalkeeping and goalkeepers. I suppose a similar question to, as it was to Steve, with regards to time span, why goalkeepers? Not that there's anything wrong with goalkeepers. They're really important, I get that, but yeah, it's not something that's covered very often.
Yeah, when this one was floated, when Omar sent the various ideas out, this the goalkeepers one leapt out to me, and I was on it like a flash before anyone else was, because I was very keen to get into it, and I actually discovered far more as I went on looking into it. But the names that you just think of, and there's the key three of Sepp Maier in the 70s, Oliver Kahn in the 90s and the early 2000s, and then more recently Manuel Neuer. Three of the greatest goalkeepers in the world in their era, or arguably the greatest at various points in their prime. And Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, there's a quote, and I've got it in my article as well, is that he says, Bayern Munich, we've always had good goalkeepers. And simply, I think to be a Bayern great in goal, you have to also be a global goalkeeping great. And those three absolutely are. And Bayern's history, when you sort of map out their greatest peaks, so we've talked a lot about the 1970s peak. Sepp Maier was at the core of that. And yes, of course, there's always other characters, and there's always others that help push it along on the way. But he was as much key to that as Beckenbauer, Breitner, and Gerd Müller, and the others. there was that era of dominance. They didn't reach that great height again until the late 90s or beginning of this century. And this was Oliver Kahn's time. In his own way, he helped push them onto that. And then more recently, the era of dominance sees Manuel Neuer there. Each era of total dominance of Bayern, or at least of their loftiest peaks in terms of more so European football than domestic, but equally the domestic rise, it coincides with them as well. It had one of these global greats of goalkeeping in the team. And they were all seminal to it. They were all absolutely critical to not just the successes, but also the style they played. And this is one of the intriguing things that sort of came out through doing the research and doing this article, is the sort of lineage in terms of style and approach. You can see similarities and differences, but it's as though each one is building on certain characteristics of the one before, adapting them to their own way, but progressing it. You can see obvious similarities between Sepp Maier and Manuel Neuer in that they both came off their line. They both like to rush out of the box a little bit and cut things off. Now, sure, Manuel Neuer has taken this to far greater lengths and extremes than Maier did, but he still did that. You could call him way ahead of his time, because it was acting not quite to the extent of Neuer, but still slightly a bit of a sweeper in some respects, allowing the team to play a different way. They were more proactive, but equally excellent shot stoppers. Maier, you know, he was a European, a German player of the year on a number of occasions, which is, again, it's quite rare for a goalkeeper to do that, but he was central to it all. And each of these goalkeepers, they kind of form part of the club's DNA going forward. They were there for such lengthy periods that they were huge fixtures to in the club. You know, they were part of the club. They were, to all intents and purposes, the club. It just wouldn't have been the same without them. So Maier, as Stephen was saying there, from the regional Liga days, he was there through all of that and through all the rise of Bayern actually becoming a big club. Ended up winning 4 league titles and 3 European Cups. And he was forward thinking. His style was revolutionary in some ways. And he was such a positive personality. And when he had to retire in 1979, he was 35 by then, but a road accident caused him to have to cut his career a little bit short. He was replaced by the Belgian Jean-Marie Pfaff. Now, when it comes to the greats of Bayern and greats of goalkeeping, we don't necessarily think of Pfaff. And this is what I mean about the things that I picked up as I was doing the research for this, is between Maier and Oliver Kahn, there's obviously quite a lengthy spell. And Bayern weren't terrible during that time, but they just weren't quite at the total elite. You know, Pfaff got to one European Cup final, 1987, and they lost out to Porto. Had that gone differently, perhaps he would be thought of in the same way. But he was very similar to Maier in many ways. Excellent shot stopper, but equally, you know, popular in the squad, equally extrovert, outgoing. He actually conceded considerably fewer goals than Maier as well. So he actually ended up marshalling a far tighter defence. And that was something that the successors after him, when you get onto Oliver Kahn, built on. Again, his legacy might have been different had they actually won that European Cup. So it's unfortunate, I guess, in those regards. But equally, you couldn't argue that he is quite on a par with the other three greats. And therefore, it doesn't neatly fit the narrative of saying their greatest peaks came with global greats in goal. He was followed by another local hero. So there's similarities to Sepp Maier. There's a guy called Raymond Aumann. He'd be the long-term understudy to Pfaff, and he was an understudy at national level as well to Bodo Ilgner during 88 and 90 and so on. Again, he was the base of a ruthless defence just like Pfaff, but the local hero like Maier. So he's got similar characteristics and similar styles in terms of how he'd developed as well. He didn't have the longevity of the others, and Bayern didn't have the success that they did with the others as well. So again, he's one that will be forgotten. But in terms of Bayern as a club, he's a significant character again, because he's one of those. And when you talk on series that's been going out recently of Gary's Mount Rushmore, you talk about local heroes and players that the fans identify with and the club identifies with. Aumann is one of those, because he'd served his time on the bench. You know, he'd served his time as a backup and then he got his chance and he proved he was actually one of the best goalkeepers around, just a touch below the very best, which is why we don't recall him quite as fondly. But he's the kind of player that fans of these clubs love. So he has his place in their history too, but he was followed by Oliver Kahn. And this is where we get back to the true greats. He was the world's best for a time. He spent 14 years at Bayern. The characteristics differ slightly with him because he had such a great iron will, if you like, such a competitive edge that pushed Bayern to another level and he pushed himself to another level. The club itself had slipped a little bit from its lofty heights and it took a bit of time for them to get back up there. But you think of the team that got to the European Cup finals of 99, and then 2001, when they made up for the fact they'd lost so dramatically in 1999. You think of the players in there, and it's not quite as memorable, perhaps, as the team of the 70s in terms of some of those names, but Oliver Kahn is one that always will leap to mind. He was such a dominant force of personality and such a dominant goalkeeper. You can imagine the Valencia players in the 2001 final in the penalty shootout, coming up to take their penalties, already nervous, and then they see that absolute beast standing on the line in front of them. And he saved three of their penalties, and you know, it's no coincidence, I don't think. He was such a domineering character, and his sheer force of personality and force of will helped the club push forwards. And again, multiple German Player of the Year, like Meyer had been as well. Once he'd retired, though, there was another lull, and this fits the pattern of the true greats being there when Bayern are at their greatest, as though they couldn't be great without a great goalkeeper. So there was a few years of lull before Manuel Neuer came along, and he joined from Schalke in 2011. That's 3 years after Kahn had left. When he came along, we talk about people who've revolutionised the position, and I've already said how Manuel Neuer wasn't the first sweeper keeper, and he wasn't even the first sweeper keeper at Bayern Munich. But he took it to a whole new level. You could almost call him a libero with gloves on. He at times played so far forward, allowing the team to play in a completely different way because the defence didn't need to sit back so much. They could, you know, for a team that's dominant in possession as well, that helped, of course. But they could play so far up because they knew it was a lot safer behind the lines. And it took Bayern, of course, then to unprecedented highs. And equally, he was just as seminal to that and just as critical to that as Meyer and Kahn had been in their eras. And there's another quote from Rummenigge, actually. He invented the art of being a footballer as a goalkeeper, revolutionising the position. So completely changing it in the same way that you could talk of strikers of the modern era who took the game away from those who were a bit more static and just lived for the opportunity and it becoming much more involved. This was in a similar time, the likes of Drogba at Gary's club, you know, turning it into a more of an all-action player who was part of overall build-up as well as just being the one who finished it off. Neuer completely changed how goalkeeping was viewed. And I still don't think anyone's quite reached the levels he did in terms of that style of play since his peak. I mean, he's still there now, of course, but I don't think he's quite at the level he was. But equally, Bayern's level of dominance is a bit easier domestically now as well than it had been in previous eras. But there's a definite evolution, which is what came out to me in this, from Meyer through Pfaff in particular, but also Aumann, and then on to Kahn and Neuer. There's patterns that emerge through there. There's styles that are built on through those, but each is absolutely critical to Bayern's success. And equally, to flip that around, you couldn't see Bayern's success without those key characters. So going forward, you do wonder then, once Neuer has packed up and gone, who are they going to get to follow there? Who's going to be the next great? And is that going to still fit this same pattern that Bayern's greatest peaks will require one of the world's best goalkeepers to actually help them?
That's a brilliant question. I hope that's how you've left your article. I hope that's the final sort of sentence in the article without giving it away.
Can I go and change it? Yeah, I didn't think of that.
that's a great final statement, especially when I ask Stephen in a few minutes who he thinks it's going to be. Gary, Aidan makes a great point about lineage and the importance of it, and you know, and how it spans from Meyer to Neuer. the goalkeeping position, or the position of goalkeeper, is that concept of lineage the most important in that position? You only have to look at Manchester United, and they're trying to replace Peter Schmeichel, and, you know, is it the position that requires almost an unbroken sort of period of expertise, if you like? Because when you've had a great goalkeeper and all of a sudden you maybe don't have quite a great, it becomes so glaringly obvious compared to any other position on the pitch.
That's a really good point, Stu. Yeah, I guess it's true. I mean, in my club, we had Cech, and after Cech left, you know, we struggled for a bit. You know, Kepa came in, world record FIFA goalkeeper, and, you know, had problems. Then we picked up Mendy, ironically from the same club that Cech came from Rennes in France, for virtually nothing. And all of a sudden, you know, I think he's just played his 50th game for the club now, and I think he's got 29 clean sheets in the 50 game or something like that. And it does make a difference. In goalkeepers win your titles, goalkeepers win your trophies. And you know, Braden was saying that it's not unlinked that great goalkeepers were there when great Bayern were having great teams. It's not. It's exactly the point. It's very true. And I remember Meyer. I mean, I always had three things to keep in mind about Sepp Meyer. First, the size of his gloves. I mean, nobody's got hands that big. I mean, you know, those are massively oversized gloves. And the second one is that he's got this record for keeping the longest period in European Cup finals without conceding a goal. That's because they played after the game Steve was talking about earlier, after Atletico. In the first final, they played a replay. So he actually played four games in the three European Cup finals. A bit of a cheat, really. But actually, I mean, if you look at it really logically, Heinz Steyer, the Ajax goalkeeper, never conceded a goal in any of the Cup finals they played. But that's an interesting sort of point. But, I mean, you know, to keep I can't remember what the total number of minutes is, but it's a chunky, around 300 minutes. That he kept a clean sheet for in the European Cup finals. Another one is, this was the guy who got suckered by the Panenka penalty in the European Championships in 76. Meyer was probably, you know, 70s was my sort of period of football, and he was probably the most famous goalkeeper I knew at the time, non-English. And he had this aura about him. And as I had mentioned, certainly Kahn, and very much the case with Neuer as well. They've got that aura, but, you know, to get a goal past me, you've got to be something extra special. And goalkeepers, as you say, Stu, are they're such an important key element in successful teams.
And obviously, coming to you, Stephen, it's, you know, with Alisson, you know, at Liverpool now, I guess, you know, what Gary said and what Aidan said, that, and, you know, Gary, it's a great point, you know, goalkeepers win your titles. You know, you only have to look at Liverpool's Champions League final against Real Madrid the season before they won it, and then the season when they did win it.
But yeah, quite a difference.
The glaringly obvious without being glaringly obvious.
I mean, if you're talking Alisson Becker, then you know you can add goal scoring to his list of talents there as well. You know, a goal he scores put it into the Champions League for this season. So yes, no, but you know, going back to the point is that, yeah, goalkeepers are so massively, vitally important, you know, from a Liverpool perspective. Tommy Lawrence, Ray Clements, you know, Bruce Watsonall, Bruce Grobbelaar, you know, to Alisson Becker. And you between Grobbelaar and Alisson Becker, you know, we've had goalkeepers that have been reasonably talented but flattered to deceive, and we've not won titles. You know, we've not won the serious titles. You know, we've won a few pots here and there, but we've not won the big ones, you know, in the absence of, you know, a really commanding goalkeeper has this presence, that aura about them that they feel invincible. It's no coincidence that, you know, that Everton side of the mid-1980s won what they were winning with Neville Southall in goal. It's no coincidence that Manchester United did so well with Peter Schmeichel as their goalkeeper. You know, there's very few dominant teams that do well, that make such an imprint on the game, only to have a poor goalkeeper. It just doesn't really happen. You know, it really doesn't happen. you know, they are vitally important, you know, and especially, you know, when you're talking goalkeepers, we're talking here about the goalkeeper's Aidan's mentioned there and the concept of the sweeper keeper, which I fully, you know, buy into, because that's what Liverpool's goalkeepers have always been. And that's what my education has been on, because, you know, they're not just goalkeepers, they are footballers. And that's the recognition that they need, is that, you know, the very best goalkeepers aren't just goalkeepers. They are footballers. They are comfortable with the ball at their feet. They can, and especially in this era where, you know, the back pass rule, you know, it's become more and more evident that, you know, a goalkeeper that is good with the ball at the feet and has that thinking time, not that thinking time, but that speed of thought to be able to say, look, this is what I need to do with the ball, to play the ball like an outfield player, to be able to play as an outfield player. That's what these goalkeepers do, and they bring so much to a team.
I mean, you're absolutely right. And it's, I guess this is a, you know, a great link as we go from sort of from one end of the pitch to the other. And talking about the importance of players to teams and lineage or tradition or whatever you want to call it. And obviously, Gary, you know, your article looks at probably one of the greatest goal scorers of the 1970s, and then one of the great contemporary goal scorers, certainly at club level. Obviously, international level, it's slightly different with the country that he represents. But, you know, your article looking at arguably Bayern Munich's two greatest strikers, and obviously timely coming with the unfortunate passing of Gerd Müller as well.
Yeah, very much like as Aidan said when the list went out, I saw this one, and so Müller Lewandowski as the title. Oh yeah, I fancy that. So it was only when I sort of settled down and thought, well, how do you compare two strikers who played? I mean, it's always difficult to compare across eras. We're talking 40-odd years difference. You know, Müller in the 70s, Lewandowski currently. It's difficult. But what I found was it's almost a compare and contrast. Well, contrast and compare. Because there are so many differences and so many similarities between the two. I mean, for instance, Müller went to Bayern. He played a couple of years with his local junior club at Nordlingen in Bavaria. But then he moved to Munich. And he had a choice to go to either Bayern or 1860 Munich. And he chose Bayern, not because they were the bigger club, but because they were the smaller club at the time. They were playing in the regional league, as Sud, whereas 1860 Munich were playing in the Bundesliga. And he thought he got more chance of getting the game with Bayern than he would with 1860 Munich. I mean, Bayern fans must rejoice in that every day. He went to Bayern and was virtually a one club man for the rest of his career until he went to play in North America with San Jose Earthquakes or some strange named American team. He was way past his best by then. Whereas with Lewandowski, when he joined Bayern, he was a finished article. He was already an international striker. So there's so many differences there. And also in between the style of the two players, Müller very much the fox in the box sort of striker. All kinds of ugly goals. He'd put him in with his heel. He didn't care. So many goals and so many different ways. Whereas Lewandowski is more of a lead of the line as well. Far bigger player, far more muscular player. Scores all types of goals, but scores them from distance well. And also, he supplies more assists than Müller ever did. But the similarities are so strange when you look at the data, the figures. So just to give you just very briefly, in Müller's career, 15 years career with Bayern, he played 605 games and scored 563 goals in 605 games. This is at the top, aside from that first season, the original league of Sud, he's at the top league in all those games. Lewandowski scored 335 games, scored 304 goals. Now, those numbers don't sort of quick, rapid fire. But if you break them down, Müller's works out. He scored each game was 0.93 of a goal. 0.93 of a goal each game. Lewandowski is 0.91. The similarity is so pronounced. In 15 years, Müller averages out 40 goals per year. Lewandowski averages out 41. So the record they have, despite the different styles, Stroud have conspired to produce such a similar goal-scoring record. Oh, it's a fascinating comparison. We're not going into it, as I say. It was really weird because the differences were so vast, and yet so were the similarities. It's a fascinating study. And at the end, Omar said to me, "Don't sit on the fence, make a choice as to who was the best one." So I did.
First of all, that was like having Rachel Riley on the podcast. I'm just gonna put that out there, Gary, with your numbers and your stats.
Who the hell's Rachel?
Don't tell us who you picked.
No.
I'm assuming that's your last sentence.
Yes. Well, brilliant. That's two sentences, probably. Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay. Aidan, Gert Müller is a fascinating character. I mean, the numbers there that Gary's just given, I had no concept. I know Lewandowski, contemporary, is a great scorer, and as we know about the saturation of football media and news, and the numbers always come up. But to me, Gert Müller is one of those fascinating characters where he's almost better known for his international performances than he is for his club performances. I mean, I knew he was a great striker, but I didn't know how good a club striker he actually was, and obviously until Gary gave us those stats. But to me, I just associate him purely with international football.
Yeah, and I think that's possibly because he was so incredibly prolific at that as well. I mean, his scoring rate for West Germany was around about similar rates, or maybe even more than a goal a game, perhaps. So it was very similar, but that stands out more, of course, in consciousness because, well, television coverage of club games in Germany in those eras wouldn't have been available. People saw him in international competitions, of course. And when we look back through history, that's probably the bits that people see far more often. And yes, if you close your eyes and think of Gerd Müller playing in a game, he'd be wearing white and black, not all red, I'm quite sure. But, he only got to that position because of his Bayern Munich exploits. And he was an absolutely incredible player. And I think, aside from, he's obviously been in the news lately, as unfortunately he's died recently, but not so long before that, he was also in the news because of Lewandowski's exploits of matching and surpassing his incredible record in the Bundesliga for goals in a season. And that was something that nobody ever thought would be matched. And it hadn't been, nobody had come close for so long. And then Lewandowski has broken it. Different times, of course, and as Gary says, very hard to compare. But that just shows the fact that it's taken one of the world's finest exponents of goal scoring in modern times to actually come close and then surpass what he was achieving. And so many others who've been through Germany and been through Bayern since then couldn't come close to it. What a remarkable talent he was. And he was an epic poacher, and he's the kind of guy who, if there's a half chance there or a sniff of a chance, you can bet your bottom dollar he's going to take it. If that requires spinning on a dime and firing in like he did for West Germany in the 74 World Cup final, which just set Gary off into tears, unfortunately. Sorry, Gary. But it may also have done similar things for Bayern on so many occasions. The slightest poacher's chance, he's going to take it. And that doesn't come along by chance. The greatest exponents of goal scoring know where to put themselves. And the chances won't always fall to them. But when the chance does come, they're going to be damn sure they're in the right place to get it. And he was expert at that. And that is why he got so many goals, as well as being the expert finisher and able to take the half chances. He was also brilliant at getting himself in the right position for where these chances would come along. And that is where the art of goal scoring is so magnificent, and why the people who do it the best make it look so easy, because it just seems to fall to them. But why does it fall to them? Because they knew exactly where to be, and that is Gerd Müller.
I think Stephen, one of the great things about strikers and even just this article is the physicality, and Aidan touches on it brilliantly there. The physicality is almost irrelevant. It's almost an unknown. It's just a something that great strikers have. It doesn't matter what their physicality, whether they're 6'2" or 5'5" or stocky, slim, you know, all of that. For that position, it seems to be irrelevant. It's all about the, you know, almost the intangible knack of like Aidan says, of knowing where to be. You know, and Lewandowski and Müller are a great example, yet contrast for that.
Yeah, they're like water diviners, aren't they? They know where the water is, or people who can smell oil. It's that type of essence. You know, these players just know where the ball is going to land, as Aidan said. You know, Gerd Müller was you know, the absolute master of that. You know, his figures are absolute lunacy. You know, they make him sound like a footballer from the 1930s when every game was 7-4. You know, he wasn't. You know, he was of a more relative. You know, he was of a colour television era. This is a player who scored, you know, absolute raft of goals at every level, even when he went to the NASL. And while Gary was talking, I looked at him, it was the Fort Lauderdale Strikers he went and played for. And he still scored more goals than he played matches, you know, for them, even though he was knocking on a bit by then. You know, an absolute beast of a striker. You know, and I can remember kind of like in the 80s, like, you know, kicking a ball around the park and stuff like that. And older kids would refer to themselves, or they would refer to players, you know, kids who could put the ball in the back of the net, you know. And for a time, I was one of those. I was a goal hanger. I was either goalkeeper or goal hanger, and I didn't do much else. You know, it was only later on it turned into kind of like, yeah, the lazy midfielder who'd spray the ball around. It was late, yeah, and people used to refer to the goal hangers as Gerd. That was the way, you know, that was the way it was. Oi, Gerd, you know, trap back or whatever. You know, you're not doing enough. Go and pick up someone at a corner. No, but also that, you know, on the goal hanger. And that was what it was. I think even Robbie Fowler, I think his nickname at Liverpool was Gerd. You know, and it was all in homage to Gerd Müller. This is where it all spanned from. This, you know, so synonymous with scoring goals. That, you know, he just was goals. You know, and yes, you know, so many other players, you know, picked up this. You know, propensity, and others will have had it before Gerd Müller, but, you know, it is this, you know, generational thing. And you're right, you know, it's one of these parts of football that can't be trained into you, it can't be taught. It's just something that you have. You know, you could look at like a Gary Lineker, for instance, you know, someone who doesn't really have the build as a footballer. Ian Rush, when he was younger, looked like he could blow away in the wind. You know, they're just the type of players that could, you know, that really shouldn't be on a football pitch. Some of them, you know, they don't have, as you say, the physicality for it. But because they've got that instinct of where to go, they're already three steps ahead of the you know, the Anglo-Saxon, the Neanderthalic central defender that's going to hack them down. Because, and they've got the ball in the back of the net before, you know, they can do anything about it. And it is one of the greatest parts of football.
It is, and like you say, it is that intangible. I was listening to, I can't remember, it was Five Live. It was somebody was talking, and they were talking about, it was a documentary maker, and he approached Steve Archibald, of all people. I don't know why it was Steve Archibald, but he approached Steve Archibald about doing a documentary about what goes through a goal scorer's mind just before they score, in terms of how do you know where to be, where to go. And you know, and he talked, I can't remember the name of the guy who was, it was really interesting to listen to. And it convinced me that there's a documentary in it about the art of goal scoring and how goal scorers, like you say, just have a sense almost of where to go. So, you know, guys, we've already been chatting about the magazine for sort of over an hour, which hopefully bodes well for the articles and the interest that people will find when they buy the magazine. But, you know, we've sort of talked about it before, when certainly myself, when the magazine arrives, you go straight to your own article to see what pictures have been put alongside it. And then from there, you go to the sort of article when the list comes out of which one you're looking forward to the most. Sorry. So with that in mind, this is now a new thing that I've just thought of, and this is like a recommendation corner. So what I'm going to get you to do now is recommend, other than your own, an article for people who are listening to go to as soon as the magazine arrives. Now, granted, you've not read any of them, so you can only pick it either by the title or by the author. You don't have to say what's made you choose it, but I'm going to ask you now to recommend the first article to go to once the magazine drops through people's doors. Are we okay with that? Gary, I will start with you first. You're the very first person ever into Recommendation Corner.
I'll let you decide whether I'm choosing the title or the author, but it's Breitner, and it's your piece, Stu. I always found Paul Breitner a fascinating character, and there's so many dimensions to him, not only as a football player, not as a player who played in two different positions, not only for a player who played in two World Cup finals 8 years apart, but also off the field, very politically aware, and fascinating story. So I'll be looking at the Paul Breitner article, mate. I'm sure you've done it justice.
I thought it would be interesting, and then when I read about it, it became even more interesting.
I can imagine.
Straight up, like you said about the World Cup finals, I think it's Pelé, Vava, Zidane and Breitner, the only people to score in two separate World Cup finals.
Correct.
And from that, I was just like, okay. And there's all sorts. I mean, hiding in apartments to avoid national service. There's all sorts goes on.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating character. That's a lot of pressure that you've just put on me there, Gary. I'm not overly grateful for that. But
sorry, bro.
That's okay. Aidan, we'll come to you next.
Well, oddly, I was tempted to pick the Breitner one as well for all those reasons you've just described, but I'll tell you what I am going for. And this is something that's completely different and much further back, and that's what will possibly be the first article in the magazine, Kurt Landauer and Nazi Defiance. This absolutely fascinates me, this era. And I've talked about it on podcasts, the political ones you've had about Italy and Mussolini and things like that and the World Cups of those times. It completely fascinates me. Similar with stories I'm researching for my own book about Austria at that time and the defiance there from the Anschluss match and things like that. These incidents and this era has always fascinated me. You know, I loved learning about this era in history at school, and I still love this era in terms of, I should point out, in terms of history and significance rather than any affection for certain things in that time. and that's what... and this article is all about Nazi defiance. Now, Kurt Landauer, I don't know much about. I don't know much about this story at all, other than to know he was an official at the club. And that's all I know about it. So I am looking forward to being thoroughly educated on that particular era of sporting history that I know nothing about in this particular case.
Excellent. And the final recommendation then, Stephen, your choice, your go-to article when it drops through the door?
Funnily enough, I was going to say Breitner. We were going to go for the hat trick. Yeah, definitely.
I have to say, to be fair, Breitner wasn't actually on Omar's list. I was going to do Rummenigge, yeah. And I was like, oh, Breitner would be a far better, character. I mentioned it to Omar.
I remember this, and I shouted from the sidelines, yes, Breitner.
You did, yeah.
It's the whole Maoist part of him. It's everything involved with him. It's the shift to Madrid. It's the World Cups. It's everything that surrounds him. You know, it's the open expansion. It's the arrogance as well. You know, absolutely everything I love about him. But if I can't have that one, I would have gone for Kurt Landauer as well. So I've been trawling through the list, and I'm going to go for Beckenbauer simply because, you know, the Adidas Beckenbauers are a damn good pair of trainers.
It's as good a reason as any.
And it's also been written by the wonderful Paul McParlan as well, so it is guaranteed to be a wonderful thing. Oh. But it is like shooting fish in a barrel, though, with this, as ever, with this magazine. You know, there's something absolutely across the whole spectrum there. You know, we're going from the 40s to present day. You know, it's a hell of a span of wonderful articles and wonderful topics. And you know, so much that you're, you know, to learn. And, you know, again, it's no matter what you think, you know, there's always something else that, that you're going to find out. And, you know, like I say, it's shooting fish in a barrel.
It's a great quote. It's like we say, it's out the 4th of October. We've recorded it incredibly early for us, even if we did have to wait about 3 weeks for one of the guests to turn up for this podcast tonight. But yeah, it's like I say, when Gary sent the list through for us of the articles, and I was just like, I think actually this might be the most interesting magazine and what I know the least about when it arrives and drops through the door. So hopefully everybody who's listening will feel the same way as well.
Well, the good thing about this magazine is that it's giving you all the reasons why, you know, you should have a touch of love for Bayern Munich. You know, why not to dislike them? You know, it's irrational in a way that if you dislike them, there's certainly on the basis of the history and the whole span of it, really. You know, if the modern version of them turn you off because of this monopoly, then, you know, just learn about what there's so much below that veneer of domination that, you know, you'd be mad not to.
Agreed. And without giving anything away, obviously we all know what the next magazine is.
Yes.
It's very much a contrast, is all I would say there.
It is a bit of a contrast. But within that as well, I mean, when we were doing this, the Bayern Munich magazine and the sad death of Gerd Müller, is that, you know, you can actually span how long the progression takes of these magazines, is that, you know, when the news filtered through, we were on the brink of kind of like sending this to kind of like to the finished article, basically. That we were, you know, we wanted to put in a homage to of some description, and Omar's pulled together something absolutely wonderful in honor of Gerd Müller. That basically, you know, it sneaked in there at the last minute, but you know, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's a, you know, thing of visual beauty.
Yeah, and you're right, and timing's everything, but yeah, we were lucky. The timing, if for want of a better, I feel awful now for the Müller family. I am really sorry. But in terms of being able to do him justice, we managed to get it in time, and it wasn't too late. Guys, thanks ever so much. As always, you know, it's been brilliant. You know, I have no doubt your articles will be wonderful. You've already sold them. I'm not sure about the Breitner one. It's probably just a bit bang average. But we'll let other people decide. Gary, obviously, I want to say looking forward to the magazine, but as we chatted beforehand, we've got more chance of Stephen arriving on a podcast than we have of your magazine arriving.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's my fault for moving there to Spain, I suppose. But I think, you know, as we were saying earlier, if somebody thinks about Bayern Munich and, you know, you sometimes buy the magazine, sometimes you think, well, Bayern Munich. Wait until you lift the veil and find out the stories underneath what you think the club is about. Because as the guys have mentioned, so many stories there that you know, you either know a little bit about or you know nothing about, but there's certainly a lot to learn. Some great articles there, so I'd recommend anybody going to buy the mag. I can't wait to get mine eventually.
I was going to say, yeah, they'll have won another Bundesliga title by the time we get yours. Don't worry about it. Aidan, enjoyed it? Looking forward to the magazine?
Very much so, I am actually. I'm just thinking as the guys are talking there about the veneer and what's beneath. And after this hour and a bit's chat, I'm very much looking forward to really getting into this one. I really am. So hopefully the listeners feel the same way, because there will be so many fascinating stories to tell and so much rich history to get into.
And obviously, Stephen, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
I really feel like I should just hang up here for last in, first out. a bit of a mic drop.
I mean, like we say, you know, we'll sort of finish where we start. Like we say, it's a club that sort of on the surface, there's not a lot of love for, but actually when you get into it, there is actually
so many brilliant stories about them. You know, there really is. Amazing.
Brilliant. So all that's left for me to say is a final reminder of don't forget to order the magazine. We say the same thing every time. It will sell out. It will go on eBay for a fortune. It will smell nice. It will arrive on time in this country, but it'll take a lifetime to get to Europe. All of those things never change, but it's worth reminding you. All that's left for me to say is thank you for listening, and please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.